Okay, let's get started, please. Firstly, a few announcements. I finally got the labs all sorted out and organized. If you go to the website now for the course, you'll see information about the labs. So we're running, we've got kind of three regular lab sessions a week on Mondays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, I think. Check on the website. And in addition to that, we're going to be running extra lab sessions at 5 o'clock in the afternoons in roughly the 8 days in the run-up to each of the coursework deadlines, because that's when things are going to get busier. And certainly in the last couple of days, last 2-3 days before deadlines, we'll be increasing the number of demonstrators as well in the lab to kind of allow for the fact that probably there'll be more of you in the lab at those times. So labs starting next week, starting Monday, times are on the web. Please make use of the labs, not just for the help with the practicals themselves, but the lab demonstrators are there to help you with the course in general. So if you've got any questions about any information from the course, I don't know, you've been through some past papers and you're puzzled by certain questions, go ask one of the demonstrators, especially when it's quiet away from the run-up to these coursework deadlines. The demonstrators will be able to kind of sit down with you and you'll be able to get some good one-on-one help. So a bit like the help you have from Interface, but kind of focus on this course in particular. So please make use of the labs. And so we've got the first lab this Monday, so that's even before the first coursework's going to be issued, which is going to be on Tuesday. However, I've told you already about this this work that you can do getting familiar with this SPIM or XSPIM simulator, which you'll be using for the lab, using for the coursework. So go to the web page if you haven't already, follow the link to the page which tells you about the SPIM simulator, and work through the exercises there now so that you're prepared, you're kind of up and running, ready to go with a practical when it comes out, rather than just struggling with it at the beginning. And if you've got any questions about the labs, if you've tried this weekend especially, go along on Monday to the lab session and ask the demonstrator then questions from the lab. So that's the lab. As you probably know, these lectures have been videoed. Something went wrong with the very first one in week one, but the other ones seem to be there and seem to be working okay. So I've linked to those now from the course webpage, and you can go off and view those if you want to go over things that we talked about in lecture. Go and have a look at those videos. Yes, and so the course webpage now is pretty much complete. I mean, obviously the schedule is still isn't all filled out, but if you want to see what's coming up, have a look at last year's schedule. That gives you a good idea about what's coming up this year. Things haven't changed that much. All the kind of information about the course now is there in terms of the lab times, the coursework times. The student reps as well are now listed there. So if you've got any issues about the course that you want to feed through the student reps, drop them an email or have a chat to them. Certainly too, if you've got questions or issues about the course, I'm happy to receive emails as well, or if you want to come up afterwards and ask about something, feel free to do that as well. All right, so that's for just some kind of procedural things. Let's move on to what we started to talk about on Tuesday. So I gave you on Tuesday a very brief introduction to the C language. Today I'm going to get through most of the rest of that introduction to C. Let me check, have any of you had a look over the stuff from Tuesday, and do you have any questions about anything from then before I plow on? Okay, as I said on Tuesday, with C and with any kind of thing where you can program, you kind of learn by doing. You will have an opportunity with the second practical to do some C programming, but I'd recommend that you don't wait till then. All our DICE machines have a C compiler. Today, if you haven't already, you can type in a C program like that Hello World program, compile it, and run it. And as I'll, I think, remark at the end of this lecture, I'll remark again now, there are, if you look through past papers for this course, you'll find almost everyone has a little C programming exercise which you're required to complete in the exam itself. So you probably won't be able to do that right now in the kind of time frame of an exam, but those little program exercises are really excellent little things to get you started. So I encourage you to look at those, try coding those yourself, and try running them, writing test cases for them, and running those little programs and seeing how they work and using them to guide your learning and understanding of how C works and how it's different from Java. So I really encourage you to get your feet wet, to jump in and not just treat C as something dry that you'll learn about later, but right now, go in there while your other courseworks are quite light and have a go. All right, onto the technical material. So we've got up to this slide here. So here we're walking through different data types that you have in C. So this is not showing cars. Okay. So this slide here tells you about what are called structures in C. So structures in C are a little bit like objects in C++, sorry, in Java, which you've seen. So like objects, every structure instance or every structure in C has got fields, and fields have names. So what we have here is, for example, a declaration of a structure. It's got a name point, and it's got two fields, named x and named y, and both have type int. So this actual whole thing is what we call a structure declaration. It's really a declaration of a type of structures, of a kind of structures. In this case, the name of the kind of structures is point. So this is declaring from here up to here, this is really a type declaration. And then what we're doing at the end here is we're declaring P1 to be the name of a particular point structure. So P1 is a point structure. So this whole thing here really is a type expression. It's a description of a type. Once we've declared or defined that structure type once, and we want to use it again, we can just refer to it by name. We don't have to list the body again. So here we're declaring a second variable called P2, also to be of this struct point type. So what one key observation here is that this keyword point here, it's a name of a structure, but in the syntax of C, it itself doesn't function as a type. You can't use it in a place where a type is expected. So when you want to talk about a point structure as a type, then what you have to use is this combined phrase here. You have to use the struct keyword followed by the name of the kind of structure you want to talk about. So together, these two things here are a type. And now we're saying this variable here, P2, has this type. One other observation here. So this is looking a little bit like classes in Java. In Java, you'd write the keyword class here instead of struct. The big difference, though, is that in C, things are much simpler. In the body here of a struct, you're only allowed to declare fields. You're not allowed, for example, to declare methods or functions like you do in Java. All functions have to be declared outside of structures, just at the top level of the file that you're working at, so not embedded within the definition of something else. As with objects in Java, there's this dot operator for extracting the fields of an object. So for example, if you want to talk about, we've got this variable P1, which is a point struct, and we want to talk about the field X, And in this case, we want to set the field x to some value. So we've used it on the left-hand side of an assignment, and we're going to set that field to have the value 2 in this particular assignment statement here. So this is very similar, very much like what happens in Java. When we come to passing individual structures to functions and back from functions, we have two ways of doing it in C. In Java, you always refer to objects by references, essentially by these opaque pointers whose address you can't actually see, but you know that they're pointers. So Java, you always use references. In C, we use more explicit pointers. We'll talk about pointers more shortly. Or you can actually copy all the data of a structure into the function you're calling if you're passing it as an argument. And if you're returning it as a result from a function, you're going to have the whole contents of the structure copied out from the function into, say, some variable in the enclosing program which is calling that function. We'll see a lot more about the function calling conventions shortly. There's another data structure called a union, which is much less used in C. It's something that doesn't correspond to something that you've seen in Java. But occasionally, it's still quite useful. So declaration looks a bit similar to that of a struct. Only difference, really, is where here we've got the keyword union rather than the keyword struct. And the difference is that it's to declare various fields inside. But what actually happens is the compiler treats each of these fields as being overlapping. The idea of a union structure is that you're declaring the type of a piece of storage which you could use for one of the different fields that you have declared within the union. So here we've declared two fields. We could declare three or four if we wanted. But the idea is that any one time we're using the storage declared by a union type for one of these contents, but not the others. So we could use a geom object sometimes to talk about a circle struct, and other times to talk about a rectangle struct. And then what happens is, so sometimes these things might not even have the same size. And what happens is the space reserved to the structure is the space of the largest. Question?
Explain what is this line G up at the
bottom? Right. So this is like the case was with the declaration of the struct. So with the declaration, so here, from this point here up to this closed curly parentheses, this is the description of the type, in this case the type geom object, the union type geom object. So it's a description of a type. What follows is the name of a variable which is being declared. So just like...
Do you need that name?
No, you don't.
Okay.
So just like you write int a to say a is an integer, you put the name of the type first and then you put the name of the variable second. Here, exactly the same thing's going on. We're saying, here's the type up to here, and here's a variable we're declaring in the same breath, in the same statement, to be of that type.
So by this syntax, it's very easy to create a struct just for one object. Is that like a okay practice to use in a real program?
It's probably not the nicest thing to do. I mean, very often, so what you might do is leave off geobj here, and then you might write something like union, what did I call it? Geom object G2, G3, for example. So here, this piece of syntax here is a description of a type, and it's referring back to the one that we would have been declared previously by a statement like that. And now we're saying variables G2 and G3 are variables of this type here. Okay? And we'll actually see so this sometimes is a bit of a hassle. We'll see a way of being a bit more concise very shortly in two or three slides time. So this slide here shows us the difference in how the storage is working. So on the left-hand side, what we've got is a struct declaration. Here we're just calling naming structure X. It's got two fields, both integer fields, var1 and var2. And then we're declaring a variable to be of this struct type. So in memory, the storage for that variable, storage for this structure, for this variable SX, might look something like this. So just the two variables, the storage, here we've got two words in memory, and the two words are laid out adjacent to one another. In C, there's a special compiler directive, really. It's not really a function, but you could, we'll see this later. What this is saying here, this is actually not proper C, indeed, even. But what this is trying to say is the size of the variable SX is eight bytes. So assuming here each int is 4 bytes, so the total storage here is 8 bytes. Here, with the unions, here we have a union structure, very similar. But here, the storage for var1 and var2 overlaps. So here, really just for the variable UX, only 4 bytes of storage are actually allocated. Sorry, the question there. We get var1 back, yes. So.
And the size of them is different, do we get corrupted data or?
We potentially can get corrupted data. So you have to be very, when you're using this union type, you kind of really hit the nail on the head there. When you're using this union type, you have to know somehow about what's going on elsewhere in the program, what kind of data, which of those fields of data is actually being used at any one time. Sometimes you actually do that by putting a union structure within a larger struct. So you might define a struct. Okay, maybe spot one of these. So one very common idiom in C with uses of unions is you might do something like this: define a structure, and then I don't know, maybe you just do a int field, so I'm assuming foo here is some, let's call it capital foo, say. Assuming foo has been some union type that's been previously declared. And now with the structure A, what I've done is I've paired the union with an integer, which I've given the suggestive name kind to. And the idea would be that we would use different integers here to record which of the fields of the union type we were using at any one time. So if we're using this union type up there with var1 and var2, maybe we would use, would set kind to be 1 if we were treating it as var1, or 2 if we're treating it as var2. Okay? So that's, yeah, so that's something common that we do. C has got a nice facility for introducing new names for existing types, especially when the existing types are a bit verbose or unwieldy. And it's this typedef facility. So with the typedef statement, you have the keyword typedef, the type that you want to give an abbreviation for or a new name for, and then the name itself. Here's one example. So we've got the type unsigned car. And we might want to use the much shorter name for that type of byte. So byte now, we could use byte freely in our program. Everywhere we might use unsigned car. We might, okay, this is a, um, Yes, okay. So here we have a, we're going to, we're declaring a structure. And interestingly, with this structure, we're not putting, we're not putting any keywords in here to name the structure. So the name we put in here is optional. And instead, what we're doing is we're following the description of the struct type by the word circle. So we are within a type def. So from here up to this closed parenthesis is the description of the struct type itself. And now we're saying circle is an abbreviation for that. So now when we want to talk about, say, variables C1 and C2 being of type circle, or we're declaring them to be of type circle, we can use a variable declaration like this. We can just write circle where we expect a type to appear. And then we just write the names of the variables C1 and then C2. So now this circle here is a name for a structure which is functioning just like a type. So most commonly, because this is, because it's nicer writing just the word circle rather than struct circle all the time, it's very common when we're defining new structure types to leave out the actual name of the type here and instead just put the struct definition itself within a type def, so that then we have a shorter name here that we can use to refer to that type with. Does that make sense? Any questions? All right, let's move on. Arrays. So the syntax of arrays, so C has arrays, just as Java has arrays. C arrays are somewhat similar, but they have certain quite distinct features, which we'll come to. So yes, syntax is similar. When you declare an array in C, it has a fixed size. Here's a couple of examples of declarations. Here, we're declaring n to be an array of integers, and we're saying specifically, actually, it should start off being an array of these three integers. It's an array with those three integers, those three slots, and we could change those values over time if we want to. But that's what we're saying the values should be at the start. Here's how we'd declare an array of four circles, assuming we've made a type def of the circle type as in the previous slide. Big difference between C and Java is with Java, when you have an array object, you can do something like array.size. You'd say A is declared to be an array. You could do something like A.size or A.length to actually find out how many elements are in that array. In C, you can't interrogate a variable or an object, a variable or a structure or whatever, I guess a variable of array type, and ask it, how many elements do you have? So we say that C arrays have no knowledge of their length. Furthermore, what this means is that when you run a C program and you write, you've got an array, say like n above, and somewhere in your program you write n16, If you did this in Java and you ran that program, immediately the Java runtime would throw an exception. It would say, look, there's an error, there's an out-of-bounds error at this point in the program. In C, no such luck. Your program will just carry on executing, even though position 16 does not exist in this array n. What will happen is you'll just be accessing some kind of storage in memory, which is beyond the storage for n. And you'll be reading whatever value is there. And your program will go on and do whatever it might do with that value, no matter what that may be, even though that value is some unknown, perhaps nonsense value. So this is one of the ways in which C is unsafe compared to Java. Likewise, you could even put, you could put negative indices in here, and C is not going to complain at all. It's just going to return you some data from storage near where the storage is for the array itself. And we'll see shortly more exactly how arrays are laid out in memory, and you can then actually see kind of where in memory that, that data is going to be pulled from when you have an index here which is above the range of the proper indices or below the range. We'll see very shortly that there's a close relationship between arrays and pointers. We haven't talked yet about pointers, but we will get to it. We talked a bit about them, but we'll talk more about them very shortly. And so when you're passing arrays to and from functions, just to say now, we always pass pointers to those arrays rather than the data of the arrays themselves. We don't always, but it's most common to. A common example of arrays is strings. So strings are arrays of characters, characters being 8-bit numbers. So for example, and commonly there's this ASCII encoding of characters. When we use strings, so when we use arrays for sequences of characters, strings, there's a standard convention in C that we add to the end of the string a special null character. It's represented in your programs by \0, and it actually codes for the byte of all zeros. Here's an example of a declaration of storage for an array of characters or a string. So we're saying S is a string with 10 characters. And because of this convention of always wanting to use a \0, a null character as the last character of the string, there are actually only 9 usable characters in the string. Here's an example of initializing a string at the same time as declaring space for it. So here we're saying allocate 10 bytes of storage for the string, and then fill the string, fill this, that storage with the characters string, and then a \0. So here, if you were to kind of picture what's happening, then here's the storage for string S, and we're putting the word string in, so it'll be string and \0. So the ASCII codes, so this is an array of bytes, and we're putting the ASCII codes for each of these characters into these successive bytes, and then we're putting a \0 null character at the end here in that initialization. And that initialization is actually saying nothing about what happens to these last 3 bytes, and probably the values of these last 3 bytes would be whatever they were before. So it'd just be some kind of junk characters in these positions here. That's something different from C and Java as well. In C, you often have exposure to uninitialized memory. It's something that doesn't happen in Java. It can be a huge security problem, because that uninitialized memory might actually have been used for something else in the past. Like it could have been used for somebody's password, in which case you can do wonderful things which are kind of outside what you should be doing when you're programming. You can do things which allow you to access this kind of previously initialized memory or memory that's been used in previous ways in some interesting way that you want to get hold of. Here's an example of declaring a string where we don't give the length of the string as a number, but then we immediately initialize the string here. In this case, we'd be creating a string of exactly the right length to store this sequence of characters here. So, yeah, this is kind of standard rules. Once you've, if you've allocated an array of, like a string of 100 bytes, 100 characters, you can only use those 100 characters. You can't add more characters onto the end. Well, you could try to, but actually, the storage manager and the compiler and the runtime of C is might be using the storage after the storage of your string for something else. So if you started using that, thinking you're using for the thinking that you were using it for the string, you actually might be clobbering data for some other part of your program. So like here, if you declare the string, this is a string declared to have 10 bytes. Memory obviously goes on afterwards. And this storage here might be used for something else by the compiler. And you could talk about the element S10 and S11 and S12. And you actually look at whatever's down here. And you could overwrite what's down here with no trouble at all in C. But that wouldn't be something you'd kind of want to do if you designed a proper program. All right, so common operations on strings. Here we've got, this is short for string copy. The right-hand argument is the kind of input to the copy, and this is where we're copying the data to. So we're copying these characters plus a backslash zero plus a null character over into the string S. Again, too, it's your responsibility as a programmer, a C programmer, to make sure S has enough storage for a string of this length. You can ask for the length of a string using this function strlen. Since strings are just arrays, you can use the conventional indexing syntax. So remember, arrays, arrays in C, just like in Java, start from zero. So this is an array S. This here, this top, this first location is S0, not S1. So if we talk about S5, that actually is the sixth character in that string. We can compare two strings. This is a kind of dictionary lexicographic comparison. This strcmp returns zero when they're the same, negative when and it's a negative number when S1 comes before S2 in a dictionary order, and a positive number when it comes after. So these functions are all examples of a function in a C library, a pre-compiled compilation unit that's always available when you're running your C programs. Always kind of linked in with your C programs when you run them. To refer to these function definitions, you have to pull in a header file for all these string functions. And you do that using this include statement here. If you want to learn more about these kinds of functions on strings, just type man string at a prompt in any Unix system. That the man pages include documentation on the C standard library files, like the strings files here. On to pointers, so to kind of tell you a bit more about pointers. So we've kind of seen them before in assembly language programming. So pointers are addresses of interesting data that we want to work with in memory. So here we, at the assembly language level, register S2 held an address of some data in memory, of a word in memory in particular, and we were, with this instruction, load word, loading the data at S2 into register T1. So S2 points to the location in memory. This is shown over here. This is like a fragment of the CPU here where we're seeing just one register, a register called S2. And in this case, its contents is the number, hex number 100, which, since we're treating the register as a pointer, this number here is an address in memory. So this is a pointer to data, which is actually at address hex 100. So pointer is just address of data in memory. So in this case, we're storing a pointer in a register of the CPU. But we can actually store, we can treat pointers themselves as data. So in particular, for example, we could have another location in memory that also holds the address of this data here. So we can have another location in memory which holds the number 100. And our programs will be able to use this address, use this number here as an address to then talk about that data. And we'll see in the next slide how we go about doing that. So a C pointer is a variable that holds the address of a piece of data. This is how we declare a variable to be a pointer. So here we say int star p, and this says p, we're declaring a variable p, which is a pointer to an integer. We'll see shortly why this particular syntax with a star is used. When we declare something to be a pointer, we always have to say what it's a pointer to. And you'll see shortly why. So saying here p is a pointer to an integer. Here are some basic things you can do with pointers. Actually, this is initializing a pointer. We're assuming previously there's been some declaration, just int I. So I is an integer variable, perhaps a local variable within a function, perhaps a global variable, a static variable in memory. But with this, what we're saying is, with the ampersand character, we're saying find the address of that variable. And now we're assigning the pointer p to have value that address. So this reads p gets the address of the variable I. So that's how we get the address of some data in the first place, one way we can do that. Here we see how we can start using the location pointer to. So whenever we have the expression now star p, and p is a pointer, this refers to the location pointer to. And if we use this on the left-hand side of an assignment, we're saying evaluate the expression on the right-hand side and put the value into that location pointer to. If we'd use this star p on the right-hand side, then it would say get the value from that location pointer to. So we can use star p both on the left and right-hand side of an assignment. Now the syntax up here perhaps makes a bit more sense. The way in which we read this is this declares p to be a pointer because dereferencing p gives us an integer. This operation star is called a dereferencing operation. We're kind of finding what is being referenced by the pointer. Everybody with me? Any questions? All right. So on to kind of how we want use of pointers as arguments to functions. So in Java, as I think I said before, when you pass arguments to a method, if you're passing an object, you're always passing objects by reference. So you're always passing pointers, essentially hidden pointers, to those objects, to a method when you're calling that method with an object argument. And when you pass it primitive values like integers, you're actually copying the value itself. So that's what's been set up here. In C, there's nothing as clever, things are more basic. Every time you make a function call, what's been passed to that function as arguments are the values of the data in each of the argument, in each of the function call fields, the argument fields. So to get the effect of pass by reference, though, because we can talk about pointers directly, what we do is we pass a pointer into the function. We'll see an example of this now in the next slide. So say, for example, in some program, we've declared x and y to be integers. We've been doing things with x and y, and at some point in that program, we want to take the value that's in x, the variable x, and make y have that value, and take the value in y, and make x have that value. So we want to swap the values. So you might be inclined to, we might want to write a procedure called swap, which you can pass as arguments x and y. So what you might try doing is writing it like swap wrong up the top. And if you tried this, so it seems to be doing something vaguely sensible. It's taking arguments a and b, and it's saving the value of a in some temporary variable t. Then it's setting a, the new value of a, to be the old value of b. Now the new value of b gets the value of the temporary, so the new value of b is the old value of a. So this is looking maybe a bit plausible. However, if you wrote this, compiled this, and executed it, you would find it does absolutely nothing. Could somebody tell me why? It's all to do with pass by value. I think you're right as well. So what's happening when we're making this call here, swap? What's being passed to the swap function is the value of x and the value of y. Call by value. But what that swap wrong, if we're considering swap wrong at the top there, what isn't being passed is any information about actually the storage where x is held and the storage where y is held. All that's been passed is the values themselves. So when the body of swap executes, it's swapping around the local values of the arguments A and B up there, but then nothing's done with those arguments, they're just lost, so nothing happens at all. When we want to write swap correctly, what we write is the program at the bottom of the page, this one here. We declare A and B to be pointers to integers. So now A and B, when we call swap, we wouldn't write it like this, we would write it like at the bottom there, or we'd put ampersands in here. We'd say swap, pass it the address of the data x and the address of the, address of the variable x and the address of the variable y. So now we've got two pointers to these two storage locations where x and y are held, and now the effect of the body here is to really swap over what's stored in each of those locations. So if we execute this correct swap here, in this case here, if x started off as 2, if x was 2 here and y was 3, then down here we'd have x would be 3 and would have y as 2. So this would work because what we're doing is passing pointers to the x and to the y. Does that make sense? Okay, we'll start to look at how arrays and pointers are quite closely related. What have we got here? We're declaring A to be an array of 10 integers. We're declaring P to be a pointer to an integer. If we dereference P, we get an integer. We can now do the following. we can say P equals the address of A0. So when you've got an array of 10 integers in memory, those integers, if this is the array A, then we've got 10 locations laid out in memory. A0 is the first one, A1 is the second one, and so on. And now we're saying P is a variable, sorry, P is a pointer. And we can say P gets the address of A0. So if P, if we've got some box here for our variable P, its value here is a pointer, which points to this location here, the start of the array A. Now things get more interesting, even more interesting. If we consider the expression P plus 1, this points to A1. Now something quite interesting is going on here, because this arithmetic here is not arithmetic on addresses, on the numerical value of addresses, exactly. Because if this is some address, let's just call it, say the address was 0x100, just for sake of argument. The address here would be what? Is it 101? If not, what is it? 104. So this array here is an array of integers. Let's assume integers are 4 bytes. So actually, the next element in the array is not 1 byte down, but it's 4 bytes down. So the address here is 4 bytes on. So this, when we've got this pointer, and we add 1 to that pointer, the compiler knows about the type of this pointer. It knows P is a pointer to an integer. And it knows that if you're adding 1 to that pointer, what you're wanting to do is to look at the next thing of the type of the pointer in the array. So it says this is pointing to A0, so P plus 1 must be pointing to A1. So it knows the type, because the compiler knows the type of P, it knows that P plus 1 should actually be compiled at the kind of assembly language level as the address of, as this address plus 4. So that's what's been said here. The compiler multiplies the plus 1 with the data type size. In this case, the size 4, because P is a pointer to an integer. We put in some other data type here with some other size, say size 10, then actually this plus 1 would be a plus 10 at the assembly code level. So in general, P plus I points to AI. And we can dereference P plus I, and we can use that in our program wherever we might use AI. So here we're kind of using pointers where we might use arrays. We can actually start even mixing up things a bit more. We can treat the name of an array sometimes as the address of the start of the array, like a pointer. So we can actually add to the name of an array some integer, and this is interpreted as pointer addition, adding an integer value to a pointer, and so looking at the ith element of the array, or giving us a pointer to the ith element of the array, and then dereferencing that, it gives us an expression which talks about the storage at that ith element. So this here is a fancy way of writing, is another way of writing AI. And we could even write PI for this expression here. So we can use array indexing syntax to refer to the storage, which is kind of I locations on from where P points to. Is that making sense? One difference, though, to remember here is when we declare A to be an array here, it's always talking about one particular piece of storage in memory. Whereas with a pointer, we can change the storage it points to at different places in the program. So here we're saying P equals the address of A0. Later on in our program, we could say P equals address of A1, or maybe P equals the address of B1, where B is another array of integers. So there's an important difference. They're not the same. So declaring something to be an array and having something which is a pointer, not the same thing. It's a bit of a difference. All right. There are more slides. I'm out of time. I'll need to catch up on the rest of the stuff next time. Let's stop here now.